It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about the Milwaukee and Madison rallies that were held last night in solidarity with Charlottesville.
First, white supremacists violently clash with counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. During the rally, a speeding car slammed into a group of counter-protesters, killing one person and injuring 19 others. Two state troopers who were monitoring the demonstrations were also killed when their helicopter crashed.
Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe declared a state of emergency, and President Trump made a statement when the clashes took place over the weekend. After being criticized for not singling out white supremacists or neo-Nazis, the president made another statement today.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
Nathan Moore is a steering committee member of the group Together Seaville, a local political activist organization in Charlottesville. He's a former news director of WORT Community Radio in Madison. He joined us earlier today from Charlottesville to tell us what happened. Nathan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks much. I'm glad to be here.
What brought the white supremacists to Charlottesville this weekend?
Well, ostensibly, they were here to protect their history and protest the removal of the planned removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee in a downtown park that was called Lee Park, has been renamed Emancipation Park, and there is a plan for the removal of the Lee statue that the city council here voted to approve earlier this year. That was their ostensible reason for coming and to exercise their so-called free speech rights on this. That was really a big ruse. Their reason for coming was to terrorize the people of Charlottesville.
And the authorities, the local authorities, knew that they were coming, correct? They had to apply for a permit.
Yes, and there was a lot of back and forth on how that permit would go. Not to get into the weeds too much, but they did apply for a permit for a gathering of 400 people at Emancipation Park. It's not a large park. It's a small city block, and that's a fine size, 400. But then they started boasting in the media how thousands were going to be coming, and so the city tried to move them to a different park that's much larger and could actually accommodate that size, using sort of a time, place, and manner restriction on the First Amendment for public safety. The ACLU defended the Nazis in this case and won. So an injunction from the court said that no, that you have to permit it at Emancipation Park. And so they did come to Emancipation Park, and it turned into a kind of a street brawl.
Now, earlier you used the phrase, you know, they came to terrorize the people of Charlottesville. I'm paraphrasing here. Is there evidence? Is there any written statements they put out that would lead you to believe that, yes, that was their goal?
Sure. You can visit public pages that they've got at some of their internal far-right neo-Nazi and fascist media, like the Daily Stormer website, where they're talking about exactly this. They're going to stick it to the liberals. They're talking about the neighborhoods in Charlottesville where there's more people that are the N-word. They're talking about all the Jews in Charlottesville and the Jew mayor and all this kind of thing. The idea was very much to harass populations of Charlottesville that are already marginalized and to stick it to the liberals.
Now, was this just one white supremacist group, or was it several coming together? What do we know about the composition?
Yeah, it was a group that billed itself. The event was billed as Unite the Right, and it very much was a gathering of really, frankly, awful and at times vicious groups. There were neo-Confederate groups. There were neo-Nazi groups. There was the sort of fascist, what's called alt-right these days. There are a whole lot of different groups that all did manage to come together, from Richard Spencer and David Duke to some of our own local homegrown fascists like Jason Kessler. And I know, people may cringe at the use of the word fascist in cases because it has been overused maybe in the past. These people actually call themselves fascist. So, you know, I'm not overstating the case here.
Now, there was an event with this group, the white supremacist groups, on Friday night. Can you describe what happened Friday night?
Oh, Friday night's event was quite violent. They surrounded a church. So Reverend Cornell West was speaking at a church, as well as a whole lot of other local clergy. It was a clergy group, and attended by hundreds of people. The white nationalists gathered outside that with a bunch of tiki torches and then sort of marched across the street from that church to the sort of one of the main sort of quadrangles of the University of Virginia, right outside the rotunda here at UVA. It's a famous building designed by Thomas Jefferson with a statue of Jefferson out in front of it. About 20 or 30, mostly students, but also some UVA staff, circled the Jefferson statue in protest of the white nationalists wielding their tiki torches and chanting things like blood and soil. And the white nationalists surrounded them and threw tiki torch fuel on them, hit them with tiki torches, hit them with pepper spray. That was very much a violent confrontation. The police did not intervene very much in that until the white nationalists had basically left. And I think that's an open question for the university to deal with here.
And Saturday was another instance of violence. We saw another clash before actually the actual protest of the white supremacists actually even began. Tell us what happened on Saturday.
Oh, gosh. Saturday was a circus, right? I mean, any of these big demonstrations, I mean, if you've seen anything in you know, some of the stuff in Madison when Governor Walker was first elected, that was all big, but mostly, you know, people just kind of there and chanting and being present. Here in Charlottesville, on Saturday, I was actually surprised that there was not a more firm police line to keep the two groups separate. I mean, the two groups were basically right next to each other and interacting and flowing back and forth. I mean, it was almost it was impossible for there to not be some kind of confrontation. Just you get that many people in a small space. The space I'm talking about is really quite little. Emancipation Park is, and when you have, you know, thousands of people there who are you know, ideologically very, very opposed and for good reason, then you know there were some fights for sure. The event was scheduled to start at noon, but some fighting and skirmishes had already begun well before that. The actual assembly was declared to be an unlawful assembly pretty much right after noon, and so all the groups that were there were told to disperse, and for the most part did. As they marched away, of course, they were, you know, the anti-fascists, the anti-racists, who spanned also a lot of groups, from Congregate Seville to the Clergy Collective to various anti-fascist groups to the socialists. The anti-fascist groups then also, you know, heckled them and told them to get the heck out of here because they don't belong here. Hate has no home in Charlottesville. As the white nationalists left, they pepper sprayed anti-racists on their way out. The whole thing was just a mess all day long. And that was, you know, we all, you know, were certainly keeping an eye out at that point because they were dispersed. A lot of them went to a different park on the north end of town called McIntyre Park, but others did not. So there were some basically roving bands of Nazis and fascists wandering around the central part of Charlottesville. A number of anti-racist affinity groups were, you know, also grouped around trying to go and meet them where they were and stop them and have the courage to stop them. One of those groups was down on 4th and Water Street, which is just a couple blocks south of Emancipation Park, where the Unite the Right rally was originally set to occur and where it did start. So just a couple blocks south of that park, they were gathered in what's a fairly narrow street, a fairly narrow corridor just south of this very nice downtown mall, kind of like State Street in Madison in some ways. And so there were, you know, a couple hundred anti-racists there at that point. That's when a car, a gray Ford, I believe, you know, at pretty high speed came across the mall at the downtown mall crossing, one of the street crossings, and plowed into the group of people, engaged in what I would certainly call a domestic terrorism incident, and plowed into a crowd of anti-racists driven by one of the fascists that had come to Charlottesville. Reports have now indicated that he was an Ohio resident, a 20-year-old who drove this vehicle into there. And, you know, there's blood on the hands of this whole group now. There's blood on the hands of that whole group that incited this, that made this happen. And I think there's also, frankly, blood on the hands of Donald Trump and the entire Trump administration and all the Republican politicians that have played footsie and flirted with these guys over the years. And this is the culmination of what they are about. And I think we need to make it absolutely clear that this domestic terrorism incident is on the same spectrum as today's modern GOP. That I'm not overstating that. It's not that Donald Trump has himself murdered anyone, or that Steve Bannon or some of the other truly loony far-right guys in this regime have murdered anybody themselves, but they certainly have given signals. Donald Trump on Saturday, after this murder on the streets of Charlottesville happened, also gave signals to the far right nationalists, the white nationalists, that this is something that, you know, it's all sides, guys. Both sides here really is the problem. No, that's absolutely false. The problem is the white nationalists. The problem is the actual Nazis in our streets killing people. The problem is not those who oppose them. And so the thing that happened there was the car plowed in. A woman died. Her name was Heather Heyer. And she was killed. Another 19 were so injured that they went to the UVA hospital. My wife was on site. She was acting as a street medic on Saturday. She ran from McGuffey Park, where I was, over there with a couple of other street medics, treated two of the women on the ground, one with a pretty massive head injury and skull fracture, it turns out, who is going to recover, but only after quite a long time. And so, you know, there's a lot of trauma in Charlottesville today.
And lastly, as we wrap up, as someone who lives in Charlottesville, who's a steering committee member of Together Charlottesville, a political activist group, what do you hope comes out of this weekend's events, and especially the horrible tragedy of lives lost?
Yeah, we have to make some time to grieve Heather Heyer and to take a moment of silence for each of our lives for that loss. I think what I hope comes from this is that we all together resolve to recognize that there are those in America who seek to destroy lives. We must meet and challenge those people with the courage to be, with the courage to affirm life. We must meet them with the courage to work for justice and equity and build a society rooted in empathy, such that everyone can lead flourishing and meaningful and joyful lives, and not so that those who have always benefited from systems of oppression can continue to oppress. So that's my hope, is that we jointly strengthen that resolve and work together and activate and become mobilized around, frankly, some structural racism issues and pursue policy changes that will make this society more just.
Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
Nathan Moore is a steering committee member of Together Seaville, a local political activist group in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Right now, white supremacists and others protested in Charlottesville, Virginia this weekend against the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Here's Jason Kessler, organizer of the Unite the Right rally, speaking on CNN.
The statue itself is symbolic of a lot of larger issues. The primary three issues are preserving history against this censorship and revisionism, this political correctness. The second issue is being allowed to advocate for your interests as a white person, just like other groups are allowed to advocate for their interests politically. And then finally, this is about free speech. We are simply trying to express ourselves and do a demonstration.
In response, hundreds of vigils and solidarity rallies were held across the country yesterday in support of the residents of Charlottesville, Virginia, and the counter-protesters who were there. Rallies were held in several Wisconsin communities, including Marshfield, La Crosse, Oshkosh, Appleton, Richland Center, Madison, Milwaukee, and more.
We'll hear about the Madison rally in just a few minutes. Right now, John Fleissner was one of the organizers of the Milwaukee event. He's an organizer with the group Industrial Workers of the World, a grassroots labor union, and also a public school teacher. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you think it was important to organize a rally in Milwaukee after the violence this weekend in Charlottesville?
Well, I had been speaking with some people that were attending the counter-protest in Charlottesville. And even before these events happened, we knew the severity of the situation. We thought that there could be a death tomorrow, just based on some of the rhetoric that was coming out of the far-right news channels. So we knew the seriousness of the situation, and I was watching the events unfold on social media, and we got word that the car had driven high speed into the counter demonstration, and at least one person was killed. So we felt we needed to do something. We felt we needed to show that people in our community are paying attention to this, and that we wanted to express our values as a community, and that you know, we don't want hate to have a home here. We don't want these types of ideas, these fascist ideas, to be spreading into our communities, and that we wanted to show that we're willing to stand up to these ideas, and that there's a mass base of people who oppose these white supremacist ideas and these fascist ideas.
WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach was at the Milwaukee rally. He talked to attendee Brian Verdeen.
Charlottesville is Milwaukee, is Chicago, is Seattle, is, you know, USA, America. And this could have happened anywhere in USA where the Nazis, fascists rear their ugly head. You may recall it wasn't too long ago they even surfaced in West Dallas, and we were able to greet them with thousands of citizens. So it's just important to be on guard wherever fascism, Nazis, racists rear their head. The good citizens of the USA need to stand up and be there. And it's just so tragic that this young woman lost her life so ruthlessly.
And do you think that this is something, I mean, now in the news we're going to say Charlottesville and everybody knows we're going to be talking about, but is this something that could happen here, a similar rally, do you think, John?
Yeah, I think that we have to be paying attention to those kinds of things. I mean, we have seen these neo-Nazi rallies happening in Milwaukee in the past. There's a history of it. There was a shooting at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin years back. There was a neo-Nazi rally in 2011 here. So, yeah, we're keeping an eye on, you know, like what these groups are doing and what they're planning, because we don't think that they should be allowed a platform here or anywhere. And we'll be there to confront them and to show that our community stands up to this kind of hateful, violent rhetoric.
What kind of sentiments did you hear at the march and vigil this weekend?
Well, there was about 500 people there, I believe, maybe upwards of 500 people. And that just goes to show how horrified people are about this event. And, you know, people willing to stand up to the growing hate in this country. A lot of speakers talked about the need for solidarity with our immigrant neighbors who are bearing the brunt of some of this xenophobic rhetoric, and the need to support movements like Black Lives Matter. So we wanted to hit the streets and show that we're not afraid to take the streets of our neighborhood.
Here's March attendee Susan Beadle sharing her thoughts with WPR's Chuck Kornbach.
Oh, I'm very concerned. I think it's really tragic that this was allowed to happen, because the groups who gathered in Charlottesville from all around the country, this is what they intended to do all along. They're groups that openly are armed and want to beat people up and kill people who don't agree with them, who they mark as being not completely human. They're, you know, racist, they're fascist, they were hiding under their rocks, under their rotting little pits under rocks until Trump was elected. And then they were given the go-ahead.
As you see it, John, is this something, I mean, there have been, you know, Nazi groups, Klan-affiliated groups over the years. Do you see a resurgence happening?
Yeah, I think that the far right has been emboldened under the Trump administration. I mean, Trump rose to power with this anti-immigrant sentiment, the xenophobic sentiment, that the cause of problems in this country are immigrant workers who are our neighbors and our coworkers. So yeah, I think that really gave rise and gave a venue to some of these people who have been preaching this all along, and they saw an opening, and they want to recruit from the base of conservatives who have voted for Trump and bring them even further to the right. So yeah, I think that this is definitely a growing sentiment.
As we wrap up, we heard that clip from CNN, right? Unite the Right organizer Jason Kessler saying this is about preserving history from censorship, erasure, political correctness, this argument over statues of General Robert E. Lee and others. How do you respond?
Well, I think that that's like a sort of a thinly veiled a cover for their true ideas, which is that they, you know, they believe that white people are superior. They're saying that they're protecting the legacy of the South, but the legacy of the South is the legacy of slavery. So, you know, they're going to use this sort of language to kind of soften down their rhetoric. But I think that that's not going to work. I think that we've seen through this event that their true intentions is violence and oppression of marginalized communities. and to silence the people who are asserting themselves and standing up for their rights who have not been given those rights previously. So I think that people see right through that.
John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
John Fleissner is an organizer with Industrial Workers of the World. He was involved in a vigil yesterday in Milwaukee. Now Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson is with us to talk about another vigil in Madison last night. JC, hi.
Hi, Rob.
So describe last night's vigil.
So last night, this event was organized by a number of local advocacy groups, such as Indivisible Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Progressive Alliance. It happened on the Capitol steps near State Street. And, you know, I would say probably 150 to 200 people, if I had to eyeball it and estimate, you know, showed up and, you know, lit candles and were really there in solidarity with, you know, the people of Charlottesville.
And who spoke at the vigil?
There were a fair amount of speakers. I'm not going to go into all of them since we don't have time, but there were representatives from groups such as the Industrial Workers of the World, such as, you know, as we just heard from John Fleissner, he's also from that organization, members of the LGBTQ community, elected officials like Mayor Paul Soglin of Madison, as well as Alders Morris Cheeks, Barbara McKinney, and Shiva Bidar, as well as faith leaders like Jonathan Beitch.
So you got some audio, set something up for us. What did you hear?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the sentiments that I took away from the event yesterday was a call for introspection and not to think of this as something that can happen elsewhere. In particular, Sheila Stubbs spoke. She is the second vice chair on the Dane County Board of Supervisors. This is what she had to say.
Let me talk about Madison, Wisconsin, our home, and Dane County. We have some issues right here in our own backyard, so let's not always look everywhere else when we're not looking right here at home. Yes. It might not be lynching in Madison, Wisconsin, but we're still fighting a good fight for quality education, for civil rights, for protection, for fair rights. How about $15 an hour rights?
You know, Sheila Stubbs, you know, went on to say that there were a number of things that they needed to fight for. But for the most part, the sentiment was we need to start looking introspectively to make sure that this doesn't continue.
JC, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
That was Jay Carlisle Larson, Central Time producer.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Lefties and southpaws everywhere had reason to celebrate over the weekend. Yesterday was International Left-Handers Day, which organizers say is aimed at raising awareness of the everyday issues that left-handers face living in a world designed for right-handers, as described here by Ned Flanders from The Simpsons.
Well, sir, like one out of every nine Americans, I'm left-handed. And let me tell you, it ain't all peaches and cream. Your writing gets smeared. Lord help you if you want to drive a standard transmission.
Amen to that.
Right. Well, sir, I'm opening up a one-stop store for southpaws. Everything from left-handed apple peelers to left-handed zithers. Gotta call it the Leftorium.
Ooh. It's estimated that about 10% of the world's population is left-handed. And while International Left-Handers Day encourages lefties to have some fun with the whole thing, our next guest points out that there's an unfortunate dark history of left-handedness, one that still exists today.
Throughout history, he says, left-handedness has been viewed as a negative trait, often associated with various forms of mental disorders. In some cases, left-handers have been retrained to use their right hand, a practice that in some parts of the world is still done today, sometimes in gruesome ways.
Howard Kushner joins us now. He's a distinguished professor of science and society emeritus at Emory University and a professor of history emeritus at San Diego State University. His upcoming book is called On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. Howard, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Veronica and Rob, for having me on.
Well, Howard, you're a lefty yourself. You're also a scientist and a social historian. Was it kind of the nexus of all these things that made you want to look into what it really means and has meant to be left-handed?
I think two things in particular. One was being left-handed. Myself, I was always curious why I was left-handed and others weren't. More, my mother was left-handed, and what I didn't realize till later was that she had been forced to switch from her left hand as a child to use her right hand for eating, sewing, and all kinds of other things. So, and writing, of course. So I wonder why that was so that it happened to her and not to me. And then when I was working on a project about 20 years ago on Tourette syndrome, I noticed that our patients at the hospital at our clinic were more left-handed than more than 10% of Tourette's patients and attention deficits. So I wondered why that was so, and was that really true, or was that just a bias because we were dealing with people who already had a diagnosis?
This may sound like a simple question, but reading your book, maybe it is more complicated than I thought. What does it mean to be left-handed?
I guess it depends on when and where you're left-handed. Right? For me, it was a positive experience because I could play baseball, hit with my left hand, throw with my left hand, and that was an advantage when I was growing up. But in most of the world's history, left-handedness has been seen as a sign of moral omission and mental inferiority. And as a result, it becomes self-fulfilling because if you expect people not to do well, you are prejudiced against them, particularly children, then you're going to have the result you predict in the first place. So I would say that throughout human history, handedness has been a sign of these things, but actually it's not the being left-handed that matters, but the discrimination. Get rid of that and left-handers do quite well.
Getting at some of the science behind it as we try to figure out exactly what it means to be left or right-handed, it seems like there might have been a gene you might expect to be responsible for left-handedness, but it sounds like scientists are not able to find a gene. And also, you know, the traits don't really show up until kids are 3 years old. So how does this handed preference develop in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question. I wish I had the answer. But I think one of the things is when we see a behavior or something different in a population, we look for the cause as if there's a single cause. And one of the things I learned looking at left-handedness is there are probably several different routes people have to get there. And we're putting a lot of things together to make the determination someone's left-handed. So it could come, someone could be could develop a disorder in part because of the social pressure. They can become left-handed because of social pressure or right-handed because of it. But there has been a lot of work looking for the gene for left-handedness. And as happens often with scientific discoveries, someone will make a claim that they found the gene, or they think they found the gene, or they found a marker for the gene, and it'll be in the front pages of all these newspapers. And then a couple weeks later, it turns out that other scientists don't agree, and the story sort of disappears into the history books. So it's strange for something that seems so common and so part of our society that there's so many things we don't really know about it or understand.
Howard Kushner is with us. We're talking about left-handedness. His new book is On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. Let's talk about retraining. Howard, you write that your mother, and you just mentioned your mother, had been retrained to use her right hand for writing, sewing, and the like. What are the consequences when we retrain somebody who's left-handed to behave as though they're right-handed?
I think a really good illustration of the consequences is the life of King George VI. You may remember from the movie The King's Speech that he was forced to, he was a stutterer, and it turns out that between 7 and 8 years, he was forced to move from using his left hand to his right hand for writing and for eating. And the only place they didn't try to change it is his playing tennis for some reason. And one of the results that the king had, that many other of the patients we looked at in the 20th century, was stuttering as a result of hand switching. There's a mechanical reason why that might be so. And so the intervention to stop people from developing what were supposed to be cognitive disabilities from being left-handed, therefore making them into right-handers, actually had a negative effect, much greater than whatever it was people were trying to cure. And the methods used were quite horrific. The kids' hands would be tied behind their back. They'd be put with dunce caps on. They'd be repeatedly humiliated in school. And my book talks about many of these cases, and some of them is pretty happened as late as the 1960s, which even surprised me in the United States. And there are the people from all over the Western world that have these sort of left-hander clubs recently trying to create pride in left-handedness and to claim that that many things that happened to them psychologically in their life had to do with being switched.
We're talking with Howard Kushner right now, the author of the upcoming book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. And we're talking about why left-handedness is still so widely misunderstood and why it's been stigmatized throughout history. And Howard, looking at lists of people who are left-handed themselves, I saw Angelina Jolie, Tom Cruise, I think Barack Obama. There's a huge list, and it's tempting to say, well, what do these people have in common? And I guess that's my question for you. Do we know if they have certain traits in common, mental or otherwise?
One trait they have in common, especially for the older ones, is that they persisted against that, and they were very resilient. So, you know, it turns out that as a group, left-handers both test higher and lower as a group, right? So some of the left-handers do very, very well, and especially in mathematics testing, and some of them do very, very poorly. So it'd be interesting to find out what separates some from the others. But clearly, the resilience is part of it. You know that 5 of the last 10 presidents were left-handed, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it. On the other hand, which is the title of my book, of course, when we look at some of these people who are forcibly changed, and we notice that, like with the king, there were many more stutterers. What happened in the 1930s and 40s were at the University of Iowa, where speech pathology was actually born. The leaders of the speech pathology departments wondered, instead of treating these stutterers with the way they were, what would happen if they actually took the stutterers who they knew were left-handed and had been switched and switched them back to be left-handed. And what happened was, to everyone's surprise, that their stuttering went away. So not all stutterers are a result of hand switching, but a large number apparently have that relationship. And that was quite an amazing thing to read these cases and see that.
Now, stuttering, you write, over the years has been associated by many people with mental disorders, and I guess part of curing the mental disorder would be curing the so-called wrong-handedness. Has there ever been anything to that, apart from people who have been retrained, an association between being left-handed and mental disorders?
Well, it may be because, you know, we lump all left-handers together, and we shouldn't necessarily do that. And so those who are very strongly left-handed resist much more being switched back than those who are only had two or three things left-handed. Like, they might throw right-handed but eat left-handed, be left-footed or be right-footed instead. So what you have is like two ends of a spectrum. Those are strongly right-handed and those are strongly left-handed. And many people, many more than just a 10%, fit into those who are sort of weakly right-handed. So it depends on how we define left-handed. And we use a simple test that's sort of reliable, but not always reliable, which people are asked 10 questions about handedness. What foot do they use? What eye do they favor? What ear do they favor? And those who get the most numbers, the highest number of left-handers, become left-handed, and the others are seen as right-handed.
Howard Kushner is with us right now talking about his upcoming book. It's called On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. And we're talking about why left-handedness is still today so widely misunderstood and why it has been stigmatized throughout history.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you left-handed? How has it impacted your life, positively or negatively? Did anyone ever try to retrain you to write, say, with your right hand or throw or whatever? How did it go? And what questions do you have about handedness, left or right? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Scientist and social historian Howard Kushner is our guest. We're talking about left-handedness, where it comes from, why it's been stigmatized throughout history, and what science has to say about it. His upcoming book is called On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. If you're a lefty, are you proud of that distinction? Has being left-handed in a right-handed society been a challenge for you? And if so, how? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. David is with us in Raymond. David, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. What's your story, David?
Yeah, when I was in fourth grade, when our teacher was
teaching us how to hold a pencil and write in script, she had everybody put the pencil down in a certain direction at the top of our desks. Then she said, pick your pencil up and then wait. I picked my pencil up with my left hand, everybody else with the right hand. She saw me. She had a 12-inch wood ruler, smacked me in the left hand.
Said, no way.
Yeah, and said, do it again. So I realized that there was apparently, in her mind, a right answer. And then I picked up my right hand. And when she turned her back, I put it in my left hand, which is where it belonged. And then she never bothered me after that.
So you were able to go on ultimately writing with your left hand?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, in my particular case, my right arm is pretty much purely for symmetry.
All right. David, thank you so much for sharing that story. Howard, that sounds horrible that a teacher would do that. Less uncommon than I would hope, I guess, though, right? This happens.
Yeah, much less uncommon. And continuing in most of the world, actually, you know, about 10% of the population in the world is subjected to this. It's in the West, it's not. But, you know, for instance, in China, they claim that they have no left-handers or so small number of left-handers. And yet, when the Chinese move from China to the Western world, they turn out to be 10% left-handed like everybody else. The Chinese have relented a little bit because it turns out that one of the advantages of being left-handed is to improve your ping-pong game. And so now, all of a sudden, the Chinese have been pushing left-handers for ping-pong, at least.
Well, David, thanks a lot for that call. And we go next to Chris in Toma. Chris, hi.
Hi. When I was in seventh grade, I was put into a Baptist school, and they tried to force me to start writing right-handed. And at that time, I never thought it was related until I started hearing the story today that I started to develop a stutter. But the only thing I really do left-handed is write, eat, and shoot. Everything else I do is right-handed. But it was just a revelation that the stuttering was at that time.
Interesting, Chris. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And that sounds kind of in line with what you were talking about, Howard, about how there's a correlation between stuttering and being forced to switch hands.
Yeah. Whenever I do a talk and show like this and talk about stuttering and hand switching, we get many, many calls of people who say it sounds exactly what happened to them, which even surprises me sometimes.
Is it easy to switch back once you've been switched like Chris has, if you wanted to go back and say, well, maybe now things are different, I could go back to being left-handed?
I don't know if it's easy, but it's certainly doable. It was certainly easy for the stutterers because the reward was so great, which was they lost their stuttering. It depends, I suppose, how left-handed or how right-handed someone is. We use the hand as a proxy for left-sided in terms of all these other skills and motor functions. So, and also then the notion is where language is, right? If you're left-handed, is language in your right brain? And if you're right-handed, is language in your left brain? And although it seems to be more so in either case, it's not entirely so. So it becomes confusing to define exactly what we mean by left-handed and then to determine if someone switches, whether it was difficult or easy. But it's certainly doable. And all those patients' records we looked at in the 1930s and 40s, it happened all the time.
Chris, thanks for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Howard Kushner. His book, upcoming book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder and History, looking at the science and culture and history behind being left-handed. We go back to our callers. Parker is with us in Manitowish Waters. Parker, hi.
Hi. Interesting story. I never learned that I was left-handed until I was about 15 years old. And I did some things left-handed that my father taught me, and I did some things right-handed. Nobody ever said you're right-handed or left-handed until I played golf both ways. Most of my life I've played golf left-handed and then discovered when I was about 25 that I played right-handed better. I batted left-handed, threw right-handed, never thought about throwing left-handed. And then when I was about 13 or 14 years old, I was hunting with my uncle, and I missed all my shots. And so he said, gee, how could you miss that many pheasants? And then he looked at my face, and he said, you know, your cheek is swollen up. And I said, well, I have to press my face really hard down on the stock to try to line up my eye with the gun barrel. And he looked at me and he said, you know, hold your thumb up against something straight. Close your left eye. So I did. He said, did it jump? And I said, yeah. He said, you're left-handed. And the only thing I can't do right-handed is shoot. I absolutely cannot aim a rifle, and especially a bow.
Parker, thank you so much for sharing that story. I remember Howard looking at baseball cards as a kid, and there were some of those players bat left, throw right, or vice versa. I mean, some people are functionally ambidextrous or ambiguous or go back and forth, I guess.
That's right. In fact, it's actually the thing that was the most liberating for left-handers actually was sports, because of the advantage of being left-handed in competitive sports is the advantage of surprise. And so so for young boys in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s growing up, being left-handed was not seen as a deficit, and of course now for young women. So as your last caller just showed, having these alternatives actually makes it stronger as well. There was a movement at the turn of the last century to make everyone ambidextrous, and it was run by the head of the British Boy Scouts, and he believed that if everyone was ambidextrous, they used both sides of their brain, and therefore they become twice as smart. In fact, the British Boy Scouts still shake hands with their left hand. So that's interesting. So there's been these upsurges from time to time of people trying not only to argue for pride in being left-handedness, but to show real advantages and things we wouldn't think of.
And Howard, we've touched a bit on the hemispheres of the brain and the different preference for a dominant hand. What does science know about those hemispheres of the brain and how they might relate to our hands and what we're able to do, I guess, with both our hands and our brains?
Right. For many, many early researchers on the brain and right-handedness and left-handedness, use the hands you use as a proxy for what side language would be in your brain. But it's more complicated than that as you look at it more closely, because not all right-handers are actually in their opposite brain hemisphere. They're not all in their left hemisphere. About 5% are in the right hemisphere, and only 18% of left-handers are right brain. So most of them are like most right-handers. So it's this one group of people who are right-brained that probably that's where some of the issues that we look at in terms of developmental disorders or extra abilities and talents, that's where we should be looking. And it's hard to use handedness, therefore, as a proxy for that. It's misleading. So we now have better imaging techniques so we can find out where language is in someone's brain. Before, we had to wait until they were in an operation for some sort of cerebral disorder. But now the imaging techniques are inexpensive and available. So we have a much better idea.
As we start to wrap up, Howard, you've spent a lot of time now looking at left-handedness, well, your whole life in some ways, but with this book in particular, what is the biggest unsolved mystery that you're hoping somebody comes up with an answer for when it comes to handedness?
Well, I think the really big question is, why are there any left-handers at all? What purpose does it serve? After all, if there's all this discrimination against left-handers and left-handers are seen as a minority group, why did they persist? And that suggests that there must be some kind of genetic or cultural advantage that we don't know about. And so that's the big question, I think. And I guess the second big question is, what causes it, which is related to the first one.
Are we close on the trail of those answers?
I think a little bit. I think it'll work better once we don't try to explain all left-handers as having the same cause. And once we're opened up to the idea that researchers don't have to do that. It's right. One of the problems is that researchers work within their disciplines, and so when they look for a cause, they're looking within the disciplinary ways that they're thinking about it. So sometimes we need an outsider to come in and say, "Wait a minute, guys, it's a result of more than one thing, or a result of several different things."
I'll keep watching for that, Howard. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Howard Kushner is a distinguished professor of science and society emeritus at Emory University and a professor of history emeritus at San Diego State University. His forthcoming book is called On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History.
We cover the state a lot here on Central Time, and that gives us the opportunity to talk about Wisconsin cities and towns and how to pronounce, or how not to pronounce, all their names.
And we'll be honest, we've had some differences of opinion on a few of them. For instance, Rob, you and I both say Racine, mm-hmm. while some people on the show, I'm not going to name any names, say Racine.
I've heard, I don't know if it's true, I've heard some locals say in Racine, say Racine. I have not confirmed this. Of course, we say Waukesha. We've heard some people say, some old timers in the area say Waukesha.
Which I've
again,
never
I cannot
heard
confirm this. I haven't, not sure if I buy that. And then, of course, Gen Xers love to learn about how to say Milwaukee from Alice Cooper in the movie Wayne's World.
Come to Milwaukee often? Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
Kind of wish we still called it Milwaukee.
Yeah, I like the
beautiful sound
of that. I'd go with that.
I also love the sound of Lac de Flambeau, and just for the fun factor, I like Oconomowoc.
And we'd love to hear from you. Is your hometown routinely mispronounced by people? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on the Central Time Facebook page. And we should put in a plug for Mispronouncer, your go-to site to hear how Wisconsin place names are pronounced.
You're listening to Central Time.